Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Losing my connection here, Doug.
No.
I got it. Okay. Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for July the 22nd, 2019. We have two major segments in our show tonight. First, we have a series of interviews made by the VA about the experiences of veterans in dealing with post-traumatic stress and related problems. Then in our second segment tonight, we have VA News from Washington. First, let's go over to co-host Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well out there. We have a really good show tonight, and I want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show. So please feel free to call us and let us know what's on your mind. Maybe you have some veterans issues of your own. Maybe you're a veteran who's dealt with the VA in a troubling way, or maybe you're a family member and calling about a veteran. But you can call us, and David and I would be happy to talk to you about your own situation. Our number, the toll-free number, covers the entire United States, is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And as David said, we have two major segments, and the first is going to be involved interviews made by the VA with veterans. But before we get to that, I want to relay a situation that happened today, and hopefully there's a lot of veterans listening today who may have claims pending, and you're working. Maybe you're working with a DAV or a VSO, or maybe you're working with an attorney. But I had a very troubling case. This case goes back 6-7 years. Veteran was in Desert Storm, many physical disabilities, as well as PTSD, anxiety, depression, and unemployability claims. The VA denied him all along the way, as most of you veterans are familiar with that situation. So we eventually took the case up to the Board of Veteran Appeals. We won the case. The case was remanded back to the VA. I was reading the opinion, and it was a terrific opinion for the veteran. Very difficult environmental hazard issues that the BVA service connected for this veteran. But the troubling thing was the issues regarding the mental claims weren't included in the BVA's decision. Thought it was an oversight. I contacted the BVA. I have certain numbers there, and they said, we can't help you, but contact these people, the litigation department. So I did that. Never heard from them either. So over the last 3 weeks, I've probably put in 5-6 emails to the Board of Veteran Appeals up in D.C. No response. Well, this morning I was conferencing a bunch of cases, as I frequently do with a representative down there at St. Pete Regional Office, and I asked him about this case. And he pulled it up, and he saw the remand, and so that's really good for that veteran. I said, yes, it is, but I'm more interested in the mental claims. And he said, what mental claims? I said, what do you mean, what mental claims? You've had mental claims going back to 2014. And he said, Mr. Hurley, I don't see them. So what do you mean you don't see them? I pulled my file out. I said, there's a notice of disagreement, dated October 14th, 2014. It's got to be in your file. I've got 3 disability benefits questionnaires from 3 different psychologists, all sorts of statement of claims. It's got to be in there. He checks the file, and he says, it's all here. You're right. I said, well, where's my claim? He said, it's not here any longer. Someone must have just clicked the button, quote-unquote, clicked the button, and your claim was dismissed. So you've got to be kidding me. Fortunately, he's now looking at it. He realizes the error of the VA's ways, and he's going to fix it. But then he said something very disturbing to me. He said, you know, if you were no longer practicing law and your partner was no longer practicing law, or you guys were both dead, this veteran would never receive that claim. That claim was just died with you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about a claim that's worth about $300,000 to this veteran. That's how old this case is. That the VA, by the push of a button, eliminated this guy's claim. So it's very important for you veterans, whoever you're working with, to make sure that you stay on top of these things and make sure that your representative or your attorney is staying on top of these things. And, you know, David and I all the time talk about dotting your I's and crossing your T's. Well, you know, that's an understatement. This veteran could have, this case could have drastically hurt this veteran who's in his mid-40s, affected his compensation going forward. Fortunately, that's not going to turn out that way, but it could have. And when the veteran, when the person at the VA says to me, you know, if you were dead, Mr. Hurley, this claim would be would die with you. That's scary stuff. Well, back to our first segment. Post-traumatic stress is a common but often misunderstood condition that many veterans suffer from, particularly if they have been in combat. In tonight's show, thanks to the VA's online program called Make the Connection, available on YouTube and other social media platforms, we will hear from five veterans about their experiences dealing with the effects of their military service, as well as how they coped with making the transition from military to civilian life. In the first tape, we hear from an Army veteran named Dan, who served in Operation Desert Storm. He discusses his problems adjusting to civilian life and how he realized finally that he needed help to cope with his problems. So please roll tape one, Adjusting to Civilian Life with Support.
My name is Dan. I served in the Army, United States Army. I was 13 Bravo Field Artillery. I served from 1987 to 1991. My whole tour was, I was stationed in Germany, just outside of Frankfurt. I took it very serious, and I really removed the civilian side of myself. I noticed that I wasn't relating to my friends and family. The whole reason I got out was to save my marriage. We weren't fighting, it's not like we weren't getting along, but I really did start loving the Army and the military more than my wife, especially after Desert Storm. That was like the icing. That's what took the last little bit of civilian, you know, the civilian Dan away. It was, that person was gone. Coming back to the world, just the shock of everybody has a different haircut now. Everybody talks different. Everybody dresses different. Nobody talks like me. Nobody acts like me. Nobody thinks like me. I short-circuited. You know, the severe nightmares, the severe social anxiety, not being able to around crowds, couldn't go to stores, things like that. And over the years, that got worse and worse to the point where I wouldn't go anywhere without my wife, except maybe a couple, like a sporting goods store or something. When it was any place that had weapons, guns, I was comfortable. It was weird. So I became a recluse. I did drink, but I didn't do it all the time. You know, I would go out and drink, but what I would do is I would go out and go to a bar and try to find the biggest, nastiest person in there I possibly could, and I would do whatever I had to start a fight. And one night I was in an alley and I was fighting this guy, and a friend of mine came out to look for me, and he found me and he stopped it. I realized every time during one of these fights, somebody had to stop me. And what if somebody isn't there to stop me sometime, and I actually, what if I kill somebody? I realized I needed help, and I went to the VA. I told my wife, I said, I need help. And it was hard. It was incredibly hard to admit that I needed help. I started seeing a psychiatrist, and the first one didn't work. You have to find the right one. And I did finally find a good counselor there. And then also the vet center. I started getting involved with the vet center. The VA referred me there. So between the two, I was able to start integrating myself back into society. And if I hadn't gone to the VA, I would not be sitting in this chair. When I was diagnosed with PTSD, I did get some relief because now I have something to look at. I've been told why I act the way I act. Every Marine, soldier, airman, you give them a mission, they're going to succeed. And my mission was to live with PTSD. What I could relay to another veteran is, you know, we were there for each other on the field. And now we are here for each other in the world. We are the only ones that understand each other. If you have an issue, if you're at the end of that road and it doesn't look like there's any way out, go to the VA, because they have people there that understand, and they have people there that care, and they will do anything and everything they can to help you. We've sacrificed so much, sacrificing your life or your quality of life is not unacceptable. Don't give up on yourself. Go get the help you need.
I think that's great words of encouragement from Dan sharing his experiences. What do you think, Rick?
Absolutely. You know, go get the help that you need. What better message than that, you know? There's no reason that you have to suffer. I think, you know, it is tough, but there's no reason that you have to suffer. And if you can't get it at the VA, there's other places, you know. There are other groups out there. There's a lot of people who are trying to help veterans. You just have to be willing to go find it and ask other people. Ask other people who you think are doing pretty well and say, you know, what's working for you? I guarantee you, you know, someone can point you in the right direction. It's not the VA, it's someone else. But as that fellow Dan said, go get some help. Go find it. Why don't you tell us about the next...
Okay, we're next going to hear from an Army veteran named Darren, who discusses an issue that we frequently talk about on the show and we've heard from other veterans, which is making that transition from military life to civilian life, making that adjustment. So Doug, if you'll please roll the second tape.
When I got out and retired, it's a lot of apprehension because you're leaving a life that is so structured. It's so routine, and you know what kind of policies you have to follow, what kind of uniforms you have to wear, and a whole different speak. And so when you get out after 20 years of doing that, and you get into the society where, you know, they may not have the work ethic or the work values that you are accustomed to, it can be very frustrating. As well as being an armor officer, there's not many tanks out in the real world. So I was like, well, what the heck am I going to do? My skills are with, you know, armor tanks and that type of thing. So, you know, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, especially moving back to Minnesota. And in the area that we live right now, it has very small military bases and anything like that. So it's not like I could really go to work at a fort something and, you know, go to work as a contractor. So I had a lot of apprehensions when I got out of what I was going to do, where I would fit in, what kind of job I would get. And what I found out is that the skills that you bring out of the military, you know, the leadership skills, that the organizational skills, the commitment, the work ethic, and all of that is highly valuable in civilian life. But you have to also realize that civilian life is not military life. And so when you come in there and try to just go gangbusters on something, it doesn't always fly. So that was kind of hard getting used to at first. But as long as you can incorporate that, you know, you'll be all right. I mean, I remember some days where, you know, my guys would be working 24, 36, 48 hours straight when we were out in the fields. And, you know, if a tank went down, they worked till they fixed it. If it was 30 below zero, they were out there working and doing it. If it was 120 degrees, I was stationed in Fort Irwin, California for 3 years. You know, those guys were still out there working on the tanks, doing what they had to do to get the job done. And when you get into the civilian life, you know, you're kind of punching a clock in a lot of areas. Now, there are some jobs, of course, where you have that work ethic and the timelines and the suspenses, and that you have to get them done and no matter what. But for the majority of the civilian life, you know, you come in at 8, you leave at 4:30, and most of the people are leaving. And I find that probably a lot of the military people are sitting there by themselves in their office finishing whatever needed to be done that day. So I did find that there was kind of in some professions a work ethic that was punch the clock 9 to 5 and, you know, you were gone. So that kind of, you have to kind of ease into that. And to tell you the truth, the first couple years, I was a workaholic, and especially working in the Pentagon where you're working, you know, 12, 13 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, to come back and only work 8 hours a day was different, to say the least. You know, when I was going home at 4:30, I'm like, geez, shouldn't I be working another 2 or 3 hours? So it takes some getting used to. So you can almost overextend yourself, I think, when you first get out and you have that commitment to the job that maybe not everybody else has.
Well, thanks for Darren for sharing his experiences. Rick, who do we have next?
Next, we have a Marine named Marcos. He served from 2002 to 2006. Marcos was deployed 3 times, and he lost his buddies to a bomb on his last deployment. Right before coming home, because of his experience, he was frequently on edge. He was angry and began to engage in dangerous behavior. After a motorcycle accident made him stop and think, and here we go again, he reached out for the help he needed at the VA. Doug, please roll tape number 3.
My name is Marcos. I was a Marine, and I was an infantryman while I was in. Served 3 tours in Iraq. The first deployment was during the invasion, and it was really just everything happened so fast, and just coming straight out of infantry school, being exposed to combat right off the bat was definitely a shock. But things were moving at such a fast pace, I really didn't have time to think about anything. I think after my third deployment, I lost 2 buddies of mine that were in my squad to a suicide bomber. It really made me question really the importance of life and how things can end really quickly. I had been talking to them 1 minute, and literally, you know, about 20 seconds later, they're gone. And I think a lot of what was on my mind was that, you know, we had plans when we got out. We were going to go to school together. We were going to, you know, maybe get an apartment together and just live life, you know, and in a shadow of instant, that's gone. You know, especially coming from an infantry background where you're out, you know, 24/7, patrols, whatever the case is, it was very difficult for me to comprehend that I could go outside of my house at, you know, 2, 3 in the morning without a weapon and be able to walk the streets and nothing was going on. I could hear a pin drop, and it was very unsettling. The peace was very unsettling. You know, just trying to get used to not having a schedule, not having someone to answer to, not having people under me that are looking for leadership or guidance or whatever the case. I think that was probably one of the biggest issues, just not having a direction. At the time, I really didn't know what PTSD was or any of these mental issues that, you know, are now very, you know, they're out in the media and very popularized. But I think everything relating to my PTSD was pointed out by somebody else, either a friend or a family member, only because the way I reacted to situations was very aggressive. In the military, especially in the infantry, when you're out on the street, you're taught to, you know, escalation of force, to escalate situations, you know, and that's how I would view my situation, my relationships while I was in the States as a civilian. So that's how I would go from 0 to 60, and my voice would be at what most would perceive a yell. So people would ask me, why are you getting so mad? And I'm like, I'm not mad. This is just how I talk. So I was completely oblivious to any of that. One of the things that I was dealing with, and still is an issue today, is being around groups of people, you know, which was obviously if you're going on a school campus, it's kind of hard not to be around groups of people. And I felt that I couldn't go anywhere with having my back exposed, you know, with people walking behind me that I didn't know. So I'd often, you know, turn around, check, as we say in the military, you know, checking my six, making sure that nothing shady was going on behind me. My self-medication was riding motorcycles. You know, it's pretty much a cliche, you know, Marine, fast motorcycle, whatever the case. So that's how I dealt with it. And, you know, I was dealing with it. I was going, you know, 120 down the street, on public street, and, you know, made a wrong move and went down pretty hard, probably at 80 miles an hour. And as I'm laying there on my back, I'm starting to realize, like, all these things that are going on. My aggressiveness toward others, you know, me yelling, me staying up at all hours of the night, you know, partying, just really dangerous behavior. I noticed that there might be something going on, but still at this point, I'm really ignorant to what it is. I just know that something's going on. I'm not like everybody else, and it's not just because I was in the military or whatever, but my experiences might have played a part in some way, shape, or form to how I'm acting now, which is becoming self-destructive. I was in school, and you know, I had a few situations there where there were a lot of ignorant students to what was going on out in the world, and the comment hadn't been made, Iraq and Afghanistan, I didn't even know that was going on anymore, and I just completely lost it and walked out of the class, and, you know, didn't go back that semester. I'm 22 years old, you know, been through 3 combat deployments, seen friends go, had a lot of close calls myself, and now I'm here sitting in a classroom with people that don't really respect the teachers and are talking out of turn, and that kind of thing was just playing into my PTSD so much, it was making it hard to learn. So I hear about a vet center that's close to me, Gardena, California, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check it out. And while I'm there, I start talking to combat veterans and talking to other vets that I was working with, and start realizing that a lot of the symptoms that these people are dealing with, I'm dealing with as well. And I'm starting to learn a little bit more about what this PTSD thing is. And I start noticing that by working at the vet center, by being around these clinicians and speaking with other vets that have gotten help before, it was starting to help me. It really saved my life, because I really, at that point, you know, was probably at a really low time in my life, because, again, I didn't have that physical strength that I was used to in the Marines. And still dealing with this aggression that I didn't, this really unchecked aggression that I didn't really know where it was coming from, and dealing with the loss of my friends as well. So it was nice to be able to get in, speak with other combat veterans, and them reassuring me that, you know what, there are others going through this as well. So it just, it was a really positive experience and encouraged me to continue to seek counseling. And after I started receiving counseling through the vet center, I was able to better recognize my triggers. Now, was I completely able to erase all the symptoms of PTSD? Absolutely not. But I didn't let them get to a 10. I was able to spot them at maybe a level 2 or 3. So I was able to understand, you know what, I better step aside, take a breather, walk away. Is this situation really worth it? Is it really worth arguing over, making a scene in you know, public setting? I don't have to escalate the situation as I did in the past. I can now accept it and move forward, knowing that it doesn't have any bearing on my life, and I can just continue on. When you're separating from the military, your mission is to transition as successfully and issue-free as possible. Your mission now is to take care of yourself, to perform that preventative maintenance, whether that be going to the VA medical center or going to the vet center, but just put the check in the box. You know, go get checked out. I lost 2 friends this year to suicides. And, you know, it's probably the most heartbreaking thing, because you're right there, but your friends don't feel that they can reach out or they have somebody to reach out to. So it's important for not only veterans to reach out to other veterans, but if there is an issue, make it known. Confide in either another veteran that you know or come out and seek professional counseling. I know myself, it's helped me. It's helped a lot of my friends that have been going through the same exact issues to be able to get out and seek counseling, speak to their friends. And if you're not comfortable speaking to a friend or family member, then come to the Vet Center or come to the VA.
I'd like to thank Marcos. That's great, great insight, and he's a great messenger for that message that hopefully other service members, others particularly that have served in the infantry, Marines, Army, that have a similar combat experience that can relate to what Marcos was saying and realize the, kind of the steps that have to be taken. We've talked in prior shows about, you know, what the military does. They take young person, put them through boot camp, and sometimes what they need when they leave the service is kind of the reverse of the experiences they went through, where, you know, the military had basically tore them down psychologically and rebuilt them to basically be a trained killer. And you can't simply go from that to civilian life very easily in many instances without problems. And that's, Marcos is another veteran who shows that very well. So I hope veterans are listening and heed Marcos' advice. What are your thoughts, Rick?
Well, a couple of things. You know, Marcos, I think he said he was 22 by the time he got out. He was in college, and up until that time, he'd gone through three deployments. And I can't even imagine that. I know, David, you serve, so you've got more of the military experience than I do. And so but to do three deployments from the time you graduate from high school through what would be 4 years of college, to me, just seems to be, you know, unbelievable. You know, unfortunately, we do not take care of our veteran, our military people after they come back from a deployment. And we've discussed that before. I've mentioned in the past that Canada has a regular routine that after you deploy, you come back, you cannot be redeployed for 6 months. And during that 6 month period, you're supposed to, you got a family, be with your family, you know, do what you need to do to take care of yourself before they decide they're going to deploy you again. Whereas what I hear countless times from the clients that we represent is that they'll be home for 2 weeks, and next thing you know, boom, they're back out to Iraq or Afghanistan. And, you know, I've represented so many young veterans who they come in and they don't want to file a claim for compensation. And or they don't think that their issues are bad issues. You know, I survived. My buddies didn't, but I made it back. You know, I didn't lose my legs. And I remind them that, you know, the people that serve in this country are a minority compared to those who you know, graduate from high school, go off to college, and spend their 4 years, you know, in college doing the normal routine and joining a fraternity, a sorority, going to football games. I mean, that tends to be what you see most high school graduates doing, not running off to Iraq and Afghanistan and being deployed, watching your buddies be bombed and blown up and killed, all before, you know, the right old age of 22. And that's why, as Marcos pointed out, you know, you need to get that help because you've been put through something that majority of the people in this country can't even imagine what you went through. You know, we can watch movies, we can read books, we can listen to your story, but you know that we're getting it third party, secondhand. So Marcos is truly his words are encouraging, and that's just it's a great tape, David. Thanks for finding that.
Yeah, if I could add one other thing, though, it also shows us, from a human perspective, the effects of war, the effects of, and particularly combat service in the military, the effect on individual life. But also, as he related, he comes back from his deployments, and he doesn't even realize how he has changed.
Yeah.
He hasn't even realized, and what will he do? Well, he'll go get drunk at bars, and he will intentionally look out for someone to pick a fight with. I mean, it should be clear to most people with, you know, with kind of a normal way of thinking how messed up that is. And yet, to him, that was his normal. We have to realize that's what military experience, particularly combat experience with this young man between the ages of 18 and 22, what that did to him. And it comes back home to the homeland, basically, because you got these veterans coming back, and they just can't turn it off like an on and off switch. What's been done to them? They need a lot of help. But I think the other lesson is, it's a good reminder why we all need to be thinking about ways of solving conflict, international conflict, without sending young people off to war. Look what we're doing to the young generation. A war is not inevitable. And, maybe the people that ought to be sent off to war are the people that are making decisions to go to war. Because it's not 18-year-old young men and women like Marcos who make the decision to go off to war. Yeah, they signed up. They took an oath to obey their commanders. And when they're sent off to war, they're going, unless they're going to go AWOL or desert. So they're going. They're trained. They are mentally conditioned. They're mentally rebuilt to take orders and to have this idea that whatever the United States is doing is automatically a great thing, and it must be the right thing because they're being sent off by the president and leadership of the country, and that's not always the case.
David, another thing that, sorry to interrupt, but we, last week, you and I were talking, and we were talking about the film that we have produced and the next ones that we're going to produce. And, I was remarking how I just read about how the military today, hires professional, companies. And a lot of them are former recruiters to actually go out to the public and find recruits. They had a statistic that said 29% of the American population is basically the pool that they go for to put bodies in the military. And basically, this article was saying they are competing just like Microsoft, Facebook, Google, Raymond James, and all these other companies. They're all recruiting for these young men and women, age 18 years old, 19 years old, who are coming out of high school, who are coming out of college. And so it's become a business. So a lot of these young men and women are joining the service because it's a business opportunity for them. It's not some ideology. It's not, you know, grab the gun and let's go fight. They're looking at it from a business perspective, how it's going to better them down the road with you know, having a family and their children, and how they can then take care of their family and their children. Well, unfortunately, if we don't take care of these men and women when they do come back, and, you know, a lot of them have come back injured mentally, physically, then we've got a whole group of people out there that are damaged goods and are unable to get back into civilian life, and that's what we're talking here tonight. You know, we heard earlier about adjusting into civilian life from military life. So, you know, it's a huge problem. And, you know, any young person that might be listening to this or a family member, you know, before you sign up, or, you know, father and mother, before you let your child sign up, or talk to them and figure out if that's something that they really want to do, and look at pluses and minuses. Because it is a business decision, because that's the way they're treating, that's the way the people that are recruiting you, that's the way they're treating you. David, why don't you, more comments, or on to our next tape?
Let's go to the next tape, and this is a veteran named Leif. He was physically injured while deployed. went to the VA for health care, like many veterans. He didn't want to admit to some of the difficulties he was facing in his life coming home from his deployment. However, he discovered that the VA's approach was to try to treat him as a whole person, including his post-traumatic stress, to help him go on to enjoy a healthier, more fulfilled life. So, Doug, if you'll please roll tape four.
My name is Leif, Army Infantry. I was stationed in Camp Virginia in Kuwait. I was a gunner doing convoy security from Kuwait all up and down Iraq. During an IED blast, the car, you know, swerved and we hit a big pothole. And just the compression of all the weight just smashed my spine. So I ended up with 3 compression fractures, a full tear in my ligament, and then kind of concussion syndrome. When I got home, I wasn't kept on orders. When I got home, I was just told, you know, wait for your terminal leave, which would be 2 weeks for me, and then just go to the VA, they'll treat you. When I first joined up, my wife was supportive. But then when I got back and she knew I was going to deploy, things kind of got a little rough. And I believe she just didn't want to be alone. And then when I left, she was alone for, you know, a long time. And when I got home, I guess me being a little bit more angry, like just in that kind of enraged kind of, I just think arguments and things just didn't work out, and we ended up in a divorce. My first panic attack I had, I was actually still with my wife at the time, and we were walking in the shopping mall, and all of a sudden my neck just started like clenching, and I was like tripping, just going, whoa, what's going on? It was an overwhelming feeling that there was like a sniper pointing at me. I was crying, but, you know, trying to hold it in, be tough. And then all of a sudden my training took over, and I don't really remember much, but I guess I grabbed her, and we went like maybe a foot against the wall and just went out this back, you know, back way of the mall. I was really explosive coming home, getting in a lot of fights, getting really depressed where, you know, I'm wanting to end it a few times. I was always scanning, and because I was always the front gunner up in the front of the convoy. So always scanning on the freeway, and I'm driving 80 miles an hour because I want to get through the kill zone. I don't ever want to be driving slow. And when my girlfriend drives, I mean, I'm constantly being the truck commander. Turn, go, go, go. And I mean, she gets kind of annoyed sometimes, but luckily she's very patient. First 2 years, I drank every single day, morning to night. So I was self-medicating, trying to hide, you know, feelings and things like that. You know, I had the suicidal thoughts, and I just felt worthless, completely worthless. Like, you know, I'm not a good dad. Why, you know, my son's not living with me. Like, I'm not working. I'm, you know, just everything. And then, you know, the things I did over there. And so I decided to check into the psych ward at the VA. And that was a big help because I got to see a bunch of other guys and we were just all in the same boat. When I got into the VA, that's when my care really started taking place. And like a lot of guys were scared to, you know, go to the VA, or they just thought, you know, oh, I'm less of a man, or nothing's really wrong with me, I don't need to go. But me, I mean, I really did have the problems, but then when going through, you know, I learned the process, and it was real easy. You go to some warrior transition center, and they give you a caseworker, and then that caseworker books all your, you know, office visits. You don't really have to do much. You just call them, and they did everything for me. At first, I felt stupid, embarrassed. I didn't want to admit it to people that I was doing it. But once they start helping you and you're in the meetings and you have these, you know, Vietnam vets are helping everybody when you go in. And they give you tips and tricks and stuff on how to deal with it. But then they also tell you, you have to learn how to live with it.
That was an interesting way of ending that tape. You have to learn how to live with it. Wow. Pretty interesting stuff from Leif there. Well, in the final clip, we hear from a veteran who witnessed his friend's death while they were deployed together. When he finally came home, he was a different person. It seemed he had less in common with his new wife than either of them remembered, and he was often impatient with everyone and everything. Getting help at the VA was the first step toward reclaiming his life. Doug, please roll tape number 5.
My name's Todd. I was in the Army National Guard for 11 years. I started in 98, got out in 2009. I was deployed in Bosnia and Kosovo in 2003 to 2004, and then I was deployed to Iraq from 2005 to 2007. I was on a patrol with another Humvee. It was just us, the R. Bradley and a Humvee. And we rolled past a checkpoint. We were in an area where there was some suspicious activity going on, so we went to check it out, and we happened to cross a checkpoint after that was over, and the Humvee behind me hit a 200-pound IED that was in propane tanks buried pretty deep in the ground. And there was 5 people in that vehicle. 2 ended up dying. One guy was a double amputee. The other 2 guys had a couple scratches and some concussions, but that was probably about the time where everything started for me as far as like changing my life and my way of thinking and what I did things. Then I got home, and it was weird because the excitement of just being home and not having to worry about, you know, each day whether you're gonna still be around or not. So the actual excitement of being home, I think, overtook everything for about 8 months to almost a year. And then after that, you start trying to deal with the changes that have been there the whole time. You just didn't realize until then. It got to the point where my wife at the time and I, our values were different. We were never on the same page on anything. What was important to me before really wasn't that important to me anymore, and what was important to me wasn't really that important to her. She told me several times, she's like, you know, I kind of like the old you, and I said, well, that guy, he's long gone. The hardest thing is accepting that you're going to have to somehow adapt to that new guy. And a lot of times you don't want to, which is a lot of times you just resort to different things like anger. It was pretty tough, bumpy road. I just felt different about her and about our life and about the thing. Like, I always knew I could still be a good dad, and I still am, but putting, you know, 110% into your kids and then putting 20% into your marriage, wow, that doesn't work out so well. So I guess I try to just put it under, you know, not deal with it, just think to myself, it'll pass, you know. And but she'd continue to want to help in certain ways, and I didn't want it. And it got to the point where we basically just had nothing. It wasn't even a marriage. I was going through the divorce. We had separated out of the house. And, you know, kind of being there alone, just being by yourself and just realizing, you're like, it wasn't until just recently, like maybe back in February or March, that I wanted to go and get help and get some of this problem. I mean, that's 4 years of being back and saying, it's no problem. Yeah, it'll go away. Never does. It never goes away. To better the future for your family and like your kids and a future relationship, you have to find it within yourself to say it's time. I went to the vet center and I talked to a therapist there. Talking about stuff at the vet center was really, really helpful. She found certain things that I needed to, and just you lay it all out on the table, and one by one you just kind of sort of set it down. You just sort of you just put it down. You ask, you really dig inside yourself and say, it's going to be tough, but in order for me to get better, I need to drop some of this weight that you carry around. The road's not easy, but I tell you, the end result, like, I can see it. You know what I mean? I can see myself in a much better position in life. Like, once you start doing all that stuff, it's like you've already dropped all that stress and all that anxiety about it. Even the fact of just getting help, being anxious about just getting the help itself. As soon as you take that first step, it is a huge relief.
Well, that, the whole idea of letting go, that kind of comes directly from the Serenity Prayer, if anybody knows that one. But clearly, that's what you tend to have to do. Part of the recovery process is letting go, letting whatever happened go, and be good to yourself. You know, treat yourself right. Don't live in the pain. You know, all the different things that you can learn when you do get the help that you need. What do you think, David? Well, maybe we lost David there. Now we're going to move on to some news from the White House. The VA hotline, which is 855-948-2311, serves veterans, their families, caregivers, and survivors by giving them a direct non-emergency contact line available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year with agents, the majority of whom are veterans or from a veteran family who are trained to address general and common VA inquiries. The White House VA hotline is quickly becoming VA's front door for questions or concerns about VA and community resources, according to VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. While veterans are encouraged to use existing VA contact centers, the hotline offers an alternative, always the right number approach, transferring calls when needed to VA subject matter experts such as the Veterans Crisis Line. The hotline serves as VA's front door to listen to veterans' experiences, identify trends in veteran feedback, and resolve veterans' health benefits and service concerns anywhere in the department. More than half the calls to the hotline are general inquiries about VA's care, benefits, and memorial services. Concerns that cannot be resolved immediately are entered as cases accessible to the VA offices of client relations. As of April of this year, 94% of the total 157,346 cases created have been resolved. According to recent data from April, the average wait time to speak to a live agent was 9 seconds, with calls typically lasting about 15 minutes. For more information about the hotline, visit www.va.gov/VE/WHVAhotline.asp. Again, that's www.va.gov/VE/WHVAhotline.asap. Veterans, their families, caregivers, and survivors can call the White House VA hotline at 855-948-2311. The VA and White House launched Veteran Suicide Prevention Task Force. Washington, as part of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and White House initiative to curb veteran suicide, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie and Director of the House Domestic Policy Council, Joe Grogan, launched a cabinet-level task force in June to develop a national roadmap. The President's roadmap to empower veterans and end the national tragedy of suicide, an acronym is PREVENTS, task force will include a community of integration, collaboration, proposal, a national research strategy, and an implementation strategy. Efforts supporting the development of the roadmaps are already well underway and are on target for the March 2020 delivery to the White House. This is call to action. Wilkie said, in order to decrease the rate of veteran suicide, we need to engage our local and community partners in addition to leveraging the resources of the department. We need an all-hands-on-deck approach to preserve the lives of our veterans who have served our country. As such, I'm thrilled to announce that Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, the founder and president of the Given Hour, has agreed to serve as executive director of the Critical Prevents work. Dr. Van Dalen is widely recognized for changing the culture surrounding mental health and suicide and is an expert and thought leader in large system change. We are proud to have her leading this effort.
Rick, hey, David. Henry, sorry to interrupt. Since we got 5 minutes left, I wanted to make sure we mention the news about the VA and Microsoft Corporation before we go to our coaching into care segment.
Sure, go ahead.
All right. And more news from the VA and Microsoft Corporation recently formed a partnership that aims to improve how veterans living in rural areas can access VA's online services and benefits. The agreement, which was formalized a few months ago in April, allows VA and Microsoft to work together to advance and improve the quality of life of veterans by identifying opportunities to extend broadband internet connectivity to underserved rural veteran communities. According to VA Secretary Robert Wilkie, quote, this partnership will serve a particularly vulnerable population of veterans, millions of people in the U.S., including many of the 4.7 million veterans living in rural areas, lack the broadband internet connection necessary to access opportunities to learn, work, access information, and communicate, unquote. So the VA's Health Administration's Offices of Community Engagement, Connected Care, Telehealth Services, and Rural Health, along with VA's Office of Information and Technology, they aim to improve access to online VA services and benefits such as telemedicine. So that's a big step forward, and kudos to the VA and Microsoft for that government-business cooperation. Now, we're about running out of time, so, Rick, why don't we go to our Coaching Into Care
segment. Before we close tonight, we'd like to provide with our weekly reminder to veterans and their families about an important VA program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's coaching number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd once again like to remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, it's about time for us to go over this evening. Before closing, I'd like to invite our listeners, if you're interested in being on our show as a guest, to talk about an issue of interest to our listeners, military veteran issues, those affecting veterans and their families. We welcome you to do so. Just contact us. Our contact information is on our show website, which is bbsradio.com/the Veterans News Hour. Richard Hurley's phone number and email and my phone number and email are on that website. So contact us if you're interested in being a guest. And, of course, we're always looking for sponsors and advertisers on our show, which will allow us to help broaden the promotion of this show and to attract more listeners and guests as well. So we certainly invite our listeners who may be interested in a position to be a show sponsor or an advertiser, please contact us, and we'll look forward to that. I'd like to thank all of you for listening this week to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We hope that you'll all tune in next week at our current time, which is 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Mountain Time, and 4 p.m. Pacific Time here on BBS Radio Station 1. Hope until then you'll have a great week. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.